Now we will focus more closely on East Asia and look at East Asian political economical structure. And again, we take a look at the economics because they are sort of the basics of discussion nowadays and have been for the past decades, especially in East Asia. It's necessary to look first at the economics and later other aspects. Again, IMF figures. These are from World Economic Outlook published in October 2012. And these are annual GDP growth rates projections for this year. We have here in Northeast and Southeast Asia this kind of figures. Cambodia 6.5, China this year 7.8. A few years ago, it used to be 14.2, which was very high. Now it's clearly lower. At the moment, we are living a world economic recession period where no country is growing very fast. But growth rates like 6.5 for Indonesia, 6.0, Laos, People's Democratic Republic, 8.3, these were quite high. Malaysia 4.4, Myanmar 6.2, Philippines 4.8, Thailand 5.6, Vietnam 5.1. These are also quite high figures because these are in a world recession period. When both the Western European and the North American markets are clogged and don't draw in so many imports. And of course the rest of the world is felt here. South Asia, Bangladesh 6.1, Bhutan 9.9, India 4.9, Nepal 4.6, Pakistan 3.7, Sri Lanka 6.7. These are also high figures. So even in the period of world recession, when European Union is hardly growing at all, probably going to minus in this year, the rest of the world, especially this part of the world, continues growing. Which East Asian economies are also not doing badly? Australia 3.3, Hong Kong Special Administrative Region 1.8, Japan 2.2. This is a bit high figure for Japan because Japan is so rich. It normally tends to be about 1 point something, but last year there was an earthquake, big earthquake, and a nuclear disaster in Japan, spring 2011, when Japanese growth rate went rapidly down. And compared with that, the recovery of Japanese economy is going on okay. Korea 2.7, New Zealand 2.2, Singapore 2.1, Taiwan province of China 1.3. Taiwan used to be absent in international economic statistics because, as long as it was called Taiwan or Republic of China, it could not be presented there. But when it accepted that it can be called Taiwan Province of China in these charts, it now appears there. USA is also growing 2.2, not badly. Europe, area is going down, minus 0.4. United Kingdom the same. A couple of other countries, Russia, Turkey, they are also growing. Most of the world except your area, European Union, is doing quite nicely. Leading to a situation where the economic weight and also following the political weight of Europe is gradually, slowly going down in the world, and that especially East Asia is growing. One theoretical way of understanding East Asian economic development, but which also has been influencing this development a lot, has been that of Akamatsu Kaname's, Akamatsu being his surname, Kaname his family name, his personal name, his theory of Gankō Keitai Hattenran, theory of the flying geese pattern of development. He started to create this theory only in the 1930s. And it was well known in Japan also in the post-Second World War years and became famous in the area from the 1970s, 1980s onwards. It is a theory that says that we used to have a leader in the world. Well, because Akamatsu is an economist, he's not so interested in the political leadership, but he's interested in the technological leadership. The technological leader of the world is a state that always, all the time, creates new technology. It is already in the most advanced place or level of the world technology. Based on its high technological level, it creates, its companies create commercial products which is selling to the rest of the world. The other countries, other states whose educational level is high, and they watch what kind of goods are being produced in the most advanced country. And they try to create similar kinds of technologies. Often the most advanced state also exports its technologies by way of licenses. The latecomer countries buy these licenses and start producing on them their own. Anyway, they are following the leader, but also trying to catch up with it. Also developing their own technologies and their own economies. Half a century ago, in the 1950s, USA used to be the leader, and still is. It is the most important technology producer in the world. It used to be followed by Western Europe, Scandinavia also. Japan was not far behind. Latin America was expected to rise quite rapidly up because Latin American educational standards and living standards were quite high also in the post-war situation. India was also expected to follow Japan and become a new economic great power at that time. Hong Kong, Singapore, the Middle East, Africa, Southeast Asia. They were trailing behind at that time. That was the world level. And in East Asia, in the East Asian situation, in the 1980s, when Japanese economy was growing fast, it clearly was the technological and economic leader of the rest of the area. And Japanese technologies and Japanese industries by way of investment, and Japanese also goods by way of exports, flowed to the rest of the area. In terms of technological level and economic well-being, Japan was followed by Hong Kong and Singapore, two small, quite developed city-states, also Taiwan and South Korea. Then behind them came Thailand and Malaysia, Philippines and Indonesia. In 1980, Chung-ok China was already starting its economic reforms, but it was still quite at the bottom. And places like India had never fulfilled the expectations that were placed on it in earlier decades because it had adopted a quite closed economic system, also the way China had been doing. And Vietnam was still suffering from the after effects of the Vietnam War, so it was quite in the bottom. They were poor countries and not on a high technological level. Japan was leading, not the political leader, but the economic leader of Asia at that time. The Japanese miracle continued until the end of the 1980s. The flying East model is simply a metaphor for this kind of situation. The group of countries moves together to higher levels of affluence and technological level. And Japanese rapid economic growth continued until the end of the 1980s when it collapsed. Japan had become too expensive. At that time, it was calculated by the Economist Journal that if you sold Tokyo, you could buy with that money the whole United States, and if you sold the Emperor Castles and the garden in the heart of Tokyo, you could buy with that money whole Canada. So price levels, also salary levels, wage levels, all price levels in Japan went so high that it became difficult to function there economically. And all Japan was also full of debt because it was easy for companies and individuals to take loans against land holdings. Well, the whole system, Japanese domestic economic system collapsed, and Japan was no more in this system. In the 1990s, it seemed that Japan falls perhaps down, but the rest of the area still continues. Until came the so-called Asian crisis, 1997-1998. When for 2 years it seemed that the Asian economic miracle was over, and all Asian countries are in great problem, that these countries are also all following Japan downwards. But from then, as the dust settled down, China emerged as the so-called leader at the end of the 1990s, some 10, 15 years ago. Not yet as a technological leader, but simply as a state and economy producing a lot of goods and exporting lots of goods, creating so much economic dynamism in the whole world and especially in the area that China simply continued sucking in imports from Northeast and Southeast Asian countries. And became a sort of country where that all others were looking at. China, its growth will go on. It will maintain the region at a dynamic level. So China started about 10, 15 years ago to replace Japan at the most exalted and venerated place in the East Asia. While Japan had replaced China from this position about 100 years ago, in the early 20th century. So China is coming up and becoming more and more important in the East Asian system. let's then take a look how easy it would be possible to create a regional integrated system in this area. And first, let's take a look at European Union, because the European Union is the model of regional integration for the whole world. Geoffrey McNichol's article in 2005, Democracy Future, East Asian Regional Integration, is a good argument about this. It deals with relative population sizes. The European Union, Germany is the biggest state, so you put on the biggest one the figure 100, and look at the population figures of the others. UK 72, France 72, Italy 70, Spain 49. There's no big difference between the biggest state and a number of other states. If you think of American integration, the situation again is quite different. If USA is 100, Brazil is only 60, Mexico 35, Colombia 15, Argentina 13. The situation is already at this point much more dominated by one single state. And a kind of European style, it's not exactly equal, but relatively equal integration is more difficult, perhaps, in the Americas than in the EU. In South Asia, India is even more dominating. Pakistan is only at the position of 14, Bangladesh 14, Nepal 2. And European type of regional integration would not make sense in South Asia. In East Asia, situation is similar. China is 100, Indonesia 17, Japan 10, Vietnam 6, and Philippines 6. Also in East Asia, China has the potential to become the absolutely dominating power in this sense. If you look at the relative sizes of economies, calculated with purchasing power parities in South Asia, again, India would be terribly dominating, others being more backward, small and poor. In East Asia, then we would have China again dominating, but Japan would be about half of China. South Korea, Indonesia, Thailand, then smaller. Also in this sense, China would be quite dominating. So probably Western European style of integration would be quite difficult in East Asia, and much looser types of regional integration, integration would be suitable for that area. If you believe this argument, and I think this is a sensible argument. One more important thing. Even 10 years ago, I, as a political scientist, used to look at economists, what they are saying about states and the international economy and so on. But lately, we have found out that it's important to look also at what sociologists are saying about changes in the world, because we are in an unprecedented change in world history. Never before have we witnessed societies where the population becomes stable, actually starts declining, like in Japan, and very soon also in European Union, in many European Union countries. Ochiai Emiko, family name, Emiko, personal name. Professor of sociology in Kyoto University argues about fertility decline in Asia and Europe. In Western Europe, especially the decline of fertility, namely how many children are born for every individual woman, calculated statistically. 100 years ago, the normal size of children in a family used to be about 4, both in Western Europe and even higher, 6 or 7 children in Asia. And as European societies became wealthier, the number of children began to fall. Japan is here, it followed Western Europe a bit later, and East Asian states, here presented as China, Singapore, South Korea, Thailand, and have rapidly come to the same level. Whether you have one-child policy, like in China, where it has been in place for some 20 years, over 20 years, or whether you don't have it, as your society becomes more affluent, the number of children born simply drops. And there's no more much difference between East Asia and Europe at this level. Why is this important? One reason. The so-called demographic dividend, which helps state to grow more affluent fast, when we are in a situation where there are not many old people in a state and not many children in a state. And most of the population is in their middle ages, in their best working lifetime. So not many people to take care of, and most of the population working hard. This situation can last only a few decades, not very long. And most East Asian states are right now in this situation. Japan is already past it. Western Europe is already past it. When the number of old people becomes relatively big, the economic growth in any state tends to slow down, because the larger proportion of the population becomes idle, and a smaller share of the population can engage in productive activity. Second, in history, a phenomenon of people called idle young males has always been a problem in any kind of society. Idle young males who have power, they have energy, and if they have no productive things to do, they tend to create problems, trouble, violence. And the old system has been to collect these young males together and send them to war against the neighboring state, where there have also been a big number of young males. Then the young males kill each other, problem solved. Perhaps one empire was enlarged a little, perhaps the other became a bit slower, smaller, perhaps disappeared. But young, idle males, surplus of them, has been one of the demographic reasons for war throughout the history of humankind. Now, when we have less children, perhaps one in a family, perhaps two in a family, we don't have surplus males in terms of family morals and family psychology. You don't want to send your only child to war where he can die. This may bring the humankind also to a more peaceful future. We already have been enjoying in much of the world, also not everywhere, but in much of the world, a fairly stable peace since the Second World War, more than 60 years now. And we can hope that perhaps this kind of situation will go on. East Asia. This is so important in East Asia because the economies are now growing so rapidly. There's expansion. There's instability. But perhaps this demographic factor is a strong thing keeping the area in peace. Because in history, economic expansions have normally tended to bring in warfare also. We'll see, but this is important. And there will be more lectures later also on demographics in the East Asia. Where we go inside societies, mostly in Japan, because it's more, it has experienced it all. But we need to take a look also at other societies. One more thing. Security complex. Now we move towards these violent things. Security complex means a situation where a group of countries have tensions and sometimes open conflict with each other. But it does not mean real open warfare. It is a situation where all countries economically benefit from the continuation of peace. And they know that the behavior of each of them is important in maintaining the peace. For instance, there used to be tension between Brazil and Argentina, Argentina and Chile, and so on. But if they had gone to war with each other, it would have severely damaged the economies and societies of each of these states. So they maintained the peace, also quarreling with each other. This is what security complex means. It is not an integrated area, but an area where an uneasy peace is being maintained within states. India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, it is also a similar case. Sometimes small, rapid, open military conflicts, but not for long. That's in 1991, when the Cold War had ended and the world had entered a period of peace, unprecedented situation. And Latin America, Northern Africa, well, the Middle East, India, Pakistan area, Southern Africa, and Southeast Asia were considered possible conflict areas. Not so much the Northeast Asia because, well, the Cold War had ended here. China was growing, concentrating on its economy. And, well, Japan is not a very militarist nation nowadays. If you take a look at it nowadays, I think Latin America is even more stable than it used to be. And there are conflicts in Africa, but the Southern African tension after the demise of the apartheid regime in the state of South Africa has become more stable. Well, there are things in Northern Africa, Middle East, lots of them. It is the main conflict area nowadays. Something also here in the Russian for neighborhood, especially in the Caucasus area. And not much warfare, not much tension even in Southeast Asia. Well, there is some, and we will deal with it. But around China, new conflict formation have been formed. China-India competition is clear. It is in terms of nuclear weapons. It's in terms of missile technologies, how good missiles can you create to bring possible nuclear warheads to the other country. China is ahead. India is following it, trading it. There were also border tensions. Other one is China in Southeast Asia, especially around the South China Sea. The third one is here in the East China Sea, especially with Japan and China. There's quite strong tension. Korea not so much, but it is also involved to some extent in this situation. Between the two Koreas, North and South, there of course is a lot of tension. This does not mean that open warfare will break out in East Asia. But because this is the place where most changes in terms of economy are taking place at the moment, it also tends to be conflictual. It is simmering somewhere in the background all the time. And this is it for this lecture.